And Workforce Development Committee is open. I'd like to start off by saying we will not take any action today on House Bill 4127. I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 4102A. Administrator Donovan, can you give us a summary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4102A prohibits public or private post-secondary institutions of education from entering into contracts with student financial aid management firms unless the contracts meet certain requirements. It declares an emergency effective on passage. There are a couple of pieces of material on the dais that the committee has been asked to consider. One is a summary, a one-page summary of a United States GAO report on fairness of college debt and college debt cards. The full-length report, which is 160 pages, is available on the committee website on OLIS. So the one-pager is on the dais, and both the full report and the one-pager are available on the website on OLIS. There's also a New York Times newspaper article entitled Checking the Fairness of College-Provided Debit Cards. And one piece of testimony from the Oregon Institute of Technology that the OUS system has submitted on their behalf, and it is on the dais as well. With that, I'll leave you to it.
Okay, and so we have the GAO report, New York Times follow-up on that, and we have two representatives here or sponsors of the bill, Representative Colby and Vega Peterson, if you'd like to start us off.
Thank you, Chair Hatch, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Vega Peterson, and I represent House District 47, which is in East Portland. So today we're here to talk about House Bill 4102. As you know, in today's economy, having a high-quality education, it's not a luxury. It's something that all students need. It's a necessity for Oregon students. And in order to help more Oregonians meet their full potential, we must help students and their families find ways to afford high-quality education. And we need to do this even beyond high school. In 2013, we made significant strides in helping students be able to do this. We were able to give enough funding to higher education to include a reduction in tuition increases at Oregon universities from an average of 5% to an average of 3.5%. But clearly we have a lot more work to do when some Oregonians are still being priced out of a higher degree. And many others are forced to take on mountains of debt. For instance, we have a responsibility to make sure that we are protecting Oregon students from unfair fees on student loans. And that's exactly what House Bill 4102 does. There are a number of post-secondary schools that contract with third-party financial firms to manage student financial aid funds. Unfortunately, some of these third-party firms are passing on fees to our students in a way that are not transparent and that aren't fair to the students, especially since it's the most financially vulnerable students and those in need of aid who are feeling the most impact from these fees. House Bill 4102 prohibits post-secondary educational institutions from entering into contracts with financial firms to provide disbursement and management services of student financial aid funds unless specific requirements of fairness and transparency are met. Oregonians are working hard to build a brighter future for themselves, and we want to be able to support that. This is a great bill, and I urge your support.
Thank you, Chair Haas. Members of the committee, for the record, Paul Holvey, State Representative, House District 8. This bill, House Bill 4102, came from the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. It was an issue that came to us during the interim. We had interim hearings on this issue as well, trying to address some basic consumer issues around the fees that were being charged and the transparency around the accounts that are managed by third-party firms for our schools. So the bill requires transparency and disclosure of terms for the disbursement management of student aid accounts. It ensures students have options to manage their funds in a different way instead of defaulting into a particular account. The bill prohibits educational institutions from entering into contracts with third-party financial firms for accounts that include per-transaction swipe fees. These per-transaction swipe fees are punitive and discriminatory against the student population. These per-swipe transaction fees are not the industry norm. We could not find any financial institutions in Oregon that charge per-transaction swipe fees. So, in essence, it's this student population is the only one that we could find in Oregon that's getting charged every time they swipe their debit card. The bill also prohibits educational institutions from sharing, revenue sharing with these third-party financial firms. I think it's a practice that I think even Higher One, who I think you'll hear from later, is not going to continue in the future. But our concern is that Higher One is not the only financial firm in this marketplace. And we feel that our educational institutions should not be sharing in profit from fees that are being charged to students. It seems to me that if our educational institutions need to utilize these contracts, that maybe those costs should be upfront in the contract and not at the, you know, coming out of the back pockets of students. One of the issues that I have heard from some of the schools, I think, who are opposing this particular legislation is the fear of not being able to contract for these services in the future. I really question whether that is a legitimate concern or not. I guess it is a legitimate concern for the schools, and I can appreciate that. But currently, Higher One, which has several contracts around the state, has contracts that include swipe fees, and they have contracts that do not have swipe fees. They have contracts that do provide the schools to share in the revenue from the operations of the financial firm, and they have schools that do not participate in that. So, clearly, those contracts are different from institution to institution, and there's a wide range of terms in these contracts, and it seems to me that, you know, given the scenario that negotiations could result in a contract, you know, that addresses these fees in a different way. We just find that these particular fees are punitive. The expression of that fear that they're not going to be able to continue with a contract just seems, you know, kind of heavy-handed and almost a monopolistic tactic that you have no choice unless you do this. A Higher One now controls 57% of the debit card-based student accounts in the country. Thus, other competing companies control 43% of the market, providing ample substitute contracting opportunities for Oregon educational institutions should Higher One refuse to contract with such institutions absent the swipe fees. I will note that there is a multi-state class action lawsuit specifically addressing and assessing of deceptive and unusual bank fees on student accounts and is currently pending in the U.S. District Court. As is mentioned by your committee administrator, there's also, you know, some rulemaking, the GAO report looking at addressing this, U.S. Department of Education, if you look in OLIS as well under Representative Johnson's testimony, and also under my testimony, we'll find other references to some of the federal actions that are going on around these issues. But none of them are basically outlawing some of these practices or preventing these practices from happening. And nothing in these federal actions precludes the state of Oregon from doing something about it and from taking action to protect the accounts of our students. The federal government is not currently addressing this issue. The August 2012 consent order and settlement with the FDIC addressed non-sufficient funds, not swipe fees. The Department of Education is currently in the earliest stages of potential rulemaking on issues surrounding student debit cards and accounts, and there is no commitment from the rulemaking panel to specifically address swipe fees. In addition, agency rulemaking is a long and arduous process, and under current executive order should not result in the preemption of state laws on similar topics. Higher One convenience fees from 2010 amounted to $66 million from students across the country. That's $66 million out of student financial aid accounts and into a for-profit business model. To me, this seems like our educational institutions are basically shifting some of their costs onto students at the detriment of their financial aid accounts, at the detriment of them being able to afford books, tuition, and housing to get an education. We think these sorts of fees and these sorts of costs should be borne up front in the contract, not in the back end coming out against our students. I think this bill is brought to us as a consumer protection issue, and it certainly, I think, begs that question about protecting students. And I just reiterate, the students are the ones that are facing this, nobody else. I really think that this committee should consider this. I urge the committee to work this bill and send it to the floor to a vote to help protect the financial aid accounts of our students in Oregon, because I don't think we can wait for the federal government to do that. Students will lose millions of dollars through this methodology of transferring cost onto the students. I think there's a better way to do it. Thank you for listening to me, and thank you for considering this bill.
Thank you both for coming forward. I know the goal here is to help students with their debt, and in an ideal world, we wouldn't need this bill because we wouldn't have this amount of debt that has created a huge national industry simply by its existence. Any questions for our two reps, Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could, a couple. Representative Hovey, you talked about the fact that different colleges are doing this differently as far as, I mean, do you have some data on that? I'd be interested in.
Certainly. I think Portland State University, actually the schools were very, very good about supplying us mm-hmm. with the contracts that they have and what's in those contracts. Portland State University, Southern Oregon University, both have revenue sharing in their contracts, but they do not have swipe fees that their students are charged. Lane Community College, for example, does have a 50-cent swipe fee charge for their students, but does not have the revenue sharing piece. So that's been supplied to us by the schools. I can certainly provide that to you. It, that's easily done.
Okay. One other one, if I could, Mr. Chair. Are there other states that are taking similar action to what we are, or are we kind of out alone on this thing, on this issue? I mean, do we have other models of how other states have dealt with this?
I can't really answer that. I do not know specifically whether other states and perhaps the students and the Osberg testimony may reveal that. I do know that there's actions, as I mentioned, across the state through federal agencies and also through class action suits for deceptive practices involving these sorts of fees.
And one more. You said this was currently in federal district court. Is it our district court or some other district court? Do you know that?
The district court for the District of Connecticut, okay, which is the home of Higher One, I believe. Okay. But there are 9 other states that are – it's a multi-state action at this point, and I can't really – it's ongoing, about those issues. You can find – I can give you a copy of that or link to that 70-page report.
Okay.
Or thank class action suit.
Oh, just a curiosity as to which district court it might be in. So,
further questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to hear from some of the students on this. I'll go down the list, and I don't know if you want to come up as a team, but I have Tori Uehara, Jonathan Gates, Brandy Hoskins, and Eric Knoll. You want to come up together?
That's not Keith. That's your name.
Welcome. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Knopp, and members of the committee. My name is Tori Uhara, and I'm a student from Southern Oregon University and a member of the Oregon Student Association. I would like to thank you all for having students here to speak with you today. Over a year ago, I began studying at Southern Oregon University as a freshman, and one of the first things I did on campus, like many of my peers, was pick up my student ID card. At SOU, our ID cards are also debit cards that are attached to our financial aid refund through Hire One. I was told the card could be used to access my financial aid, but only through certain Hire One ATMs, and no one ever explained the multitude of fees that come along with the card to me or to my peers. I think it is important for students to be educated on their ability to opt out of the Hire One debit card account and have access to their campus's fee schedule that they have contracted with Hire One. In this way, students would have all the information needed to make an educated decision on if they want to use their Hire One debit card or not. Through these fees, students are losing the money they need to get through school for living costs, books, and food. Students are being charged a fee for each time they punch in their PIN or when a clerk runs the card as a debit rather than a credit. Whether they are using the card to buy books or to get food, fill their car with gas to get to campus, this means a PIN charge. This needs to stop. How can we say we are supporting students through financial aid when they cannot access it without losing part of it through these outrageous surcharges? No one should be profiting off of students' financial aid, not third-party distributors or the campuses themselves through revenue sharing. Nor should students be losing Oregon Opportunity Grant or Pell Grant dollars to these companies who have little stake in our state or our economy. This is a system that was devised to profit off of students and state money. This is unethical and should be better regulated by the state. To quote Rohit Chopra, the Assistant Director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, institutions of higher education should be wary of doing business with companies who have broken the law. I believe there are enough barriers keeping students from accessing higher education, and contracts which allow companies to impose fees on the poorest of students are institutional barriers keeping students from finishing school on time and adding to our debt load. I came here today all the way from Southern Oregon University because I believe that Oregon needs to take steps to protect our students from hidden fees and unexplained costs and do all that we can do to ensure that our small pot of need-based aid stays in Oregon. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. We'll take testimony from all of you and then ask questions, okay?
Good afternoon, Chair Hatch and Vice Chair Knope and all members of the Senate Education Committee. My name is Brandy Hoskins, and I'm a student at Lane Community College working on my AAOT, and I'm also the Chief of Staff at the student government there. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Financial Aid Protection Bill 4102. In references to paragraphs A and B of the bill, we need the third-party institution to send out clear and concise fee schedules. I feel if I would have had this when I first received my Hire One card, it would have prevented me from losing some of my scholarship and financial aid money. Also, to give students like myself the options to have our funds processed directly to our pre-existing bank accounts in a timely manner would have been an option I would greatly have chosen. I don't remember having the option of choosing how my funds would be dispersed to me. I just recall that I received a card in the mail and that it stated rather clearly that I needed to set up the PIN to access my funds when they were deposited to my Hire One account. I would additionally like to highlight the other sections of the bill, with paragraph F prohibiting a third-party financial firm from charging a fee every time a transaction is made using it as a debit transaction. Paragraph G, prohibiting parties from revenue sharing. This is fundamentally wrong for any party to profit off of student scholarship and financial aid money. I, as a student, along with many others just like myself, are struggling financially already, and to profit off of our scholarship and financial aid money is just wrong. We have enough fees already taken away from this money that parties profit from. This is our scholarship money, intended for our use while we obtain our education. This money is not and should not be a means for anyone to profit from. Do other parties that use SNAP, TANF, ReliaCard, or other debit cards issued from banks get charged fees to use their cards? I don't know if they do, but why are we taking the blunt end as students?
It is wrong and no way acceptable to hide and charge fees from students' financial aid money. I personally feel all these sections of the bill are crucial and that this bill should be passed. When I first started attending Lane Community College, I was affected by the fees associated with the Hire One card that was issued to me for my financial aid funds. I was completely and utterly unaware of any fees that would be charged and assessed to me using my card for debit purchases, balance inquiries, and other uses. I thought it was just like any other debit card that I have had that have been issued by banks. I used my card the first time thinking nothing of it, besides that I should have more money after uses. I came to realize that these fees added up when my card was declined. When this occurred, I was embarrassed and went to investigate why this was happening. I went online to look up my account because when I had called the number, I recall it saying I would be charged to talk with a representative. Getting into my account online took forever because it was saying my account information of my birthday and social were not correct. Eventually, I was able to get into it. But I now feel this was a tactic on the third party's part trying to get me to have to call the line and talk with a representative to be assessed a fee. When I got into my transaction account history, I was shocked at all the fees assessed to my account. It was a total of $68 in fees. That amounts to 3.5 days of gas for me to drive to and from school, or roughly 22 gallons of milk. I am a mother of 4 children, and every gallon of milk and every trip of gas makes a difference in my budget that I live off of. I have the right to know what I'm being charged, and with this bill, it will help many other students like I prepare and save scholarship and financial money and spend it for what it was intended for, and not for other parties to continually and obsessively profit from. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Gates of Gresham, Oregon. I'm a student at Portland State University now. I have a little bit of a unique perspective on this particular issue because I actually come from two different schools which have used this very, the company in question, under very different circumstances. Before coming to Portland State, I completed my 2-year degree at Mount Hood Community College, which means that I have nearly 4 years of experience with third-party financial firm at two very different schools. When I started at Mount Hood, no faculty or staff spoke to me about or even mentioned that I would be asked to submit my personal information to a banking company I never heard of. Instead, I received a mountain card in the mail with very big, bright letters that explained to me how to begin accessing my funds and how to activate my new fancy account. What was much less clear during this initial setup process was the fact that I could opt out of this account. Additionally, how long it would take, what type of information I would need to provide, the type of fees that I would be exposed to if I didn't opt out of the account. Much of this information was hidden behind terms like 5 days or more, premier account benefits. I literally looked through pages upon pages of information going through the simple sign-up process and was flabbergasted at what my next step should be. Ultimately, I decided to go with a card because I figured it can't possibly be that bad. Today, as a student of Portland State University, I am lucky now because I don't have the PIN transaction swipe fee that was mentioned by a representative. That fee associated with PIN purchases is specifically in instances where the PIN number is used or debit transactions are run. A lot of argument follows this particular point. The argument being made is that this is something you can opt out of. You can decide not to process transactions as debit fees. This is simply false. I shop for groceries every week. I shop for gasoline every week because I have to drive from Gresham into Portland State University, either to the transit center to get on the bus to get back and forth, or on the rare occasions whenever I have to physically drive in because I didn't get up in time. But the point remains, I'm not given the option to opt out of using a debit transaction at most of the places that I'm forced to shop at regularly. Winco Groceries is a great example. They don't have an option for credit purchases, which would allow me to avoid this fee on my transaction. Legitimately speaking, It's not an option for people to consider. Luckily, at Portland State University now, I don't have to worry about that additional fee, which I've been given new information today is apparently only 50 cents per transaction now at Mount Hood Community College. When I was there, my first time with a card, my fees were $1 per PIN transaction. So today, I get to spend time, instead of worrying about the $1 per fee PIN transaction, I get to spend time worrying about whether or not any of the feeless ATMs are working. I'm not sure if I've benefited or not. In the absence of considerations like that, one has to wonder whether it serves Oregon in some way to allow third-party firms to buy contracts with kickbacks. These are going to be profit-sharing agreements with the universities or schools to do business with them. What free market principle calls for schools to disperse funds through intermediaries to the students, then collect whatever the intermediary decides to cut them in for? This does not contribute to a fair or ethical system of education or finance. Are students expected to continue to pay for higher tuition, higher cost of living, higher interest rates on student loans, and fund kickbacks from the banks? Oregon should not be willing to turn a blind eye while these types of manipulative practices dictate student finance. Education about policies is crucial and critical for students who attend schools using third-party firm financial aid distribution. It needs to be made clear and concise. It needs to be that students can use their own banks, and the process of facilitating that needs to be reasonable and timely. Fees need to be clearly and concisely presented in a way that does not confuse students with account terminology or upselling. PIN fees are simply not acceptable. From personal experience dealing with them, whenever I needed to purchase diapers, whenever I needed to purchase for my 2-year-old who was outside dropping cookies on the floor, no doubt, which I'll sweep up before I leave, I racked up a fair amount of fees because I was not given an option to opt out of using the PIN fee transaction. I didn't understand how long it was going to take to get it to my normal bank account because I look at the terms and it says, well, maybe 5 days or more. Where is the realistic expectation of expediency and access to these funds? These are not funds which have been tossed into the market to be shared between profit-gaining organizations. These are funds which are intended to support the education of students in Oregon. And we really need to protect that and ensure that we're not lending these funds to questionable business practices and just chipping away at the overall progress of our students to behind the scenes to purchase contracts as well as via profit sharing, via PIN fees. Honestly, it doesn't add up to a very sustainable system in any way.
Thank you, Mr. Gates. You're our model student going to a community college for 2 years and into your career year. That's what we're – it seems like that's – what we're pointing a lot of students to, so thank you. I want to, before I call you up, Eric, open it up to questions to you three. And I'd like to begin with a question that came to me when I first heard about this issue in this legislation. And I'm reminded of it in this New York Times story. The New York Times did a story on this GAO report, and coincidentally, they put a human face on someone from Portland State University in Portland OR, Harris Foster. And what it said about him was, quote, after learning about the card in greater detail, Mr. Foster decided to simply have the funds deposited in his own checking account out of concern that all these fees would come up. I don't see why I'd use that system, he said, instead of my own bank. And so that's what immediately occurred to me, that instead of this system, why not shop around for a bank that has no fees or a credit union that has no fees and use that to, and just forget about these guys over here because of the way they set things up. So why not do that? Why aren't students doing that? That's the biggest question I have about this bill.
Do you mind? I actually can give you a pretty direct answer to that. My fiance and I, who she is also a part-time student, we do that. She runs hers to our credit union account directly. The problem with that whole process is I mentioned the kind of nebulous idea of when you'll have access to your money. We have rent due before the 5th of every month. We have to make food purchases before we run out of food in the house. And whenever my son runs out of diapers, I have to buy those diapers. I don't have the option of deciding to wait an additional and if it's on a weekend, I can be looking at 6 to 8 days for processing of those funds.
Okay, so you're talking about the time when they deposit it to the time when your bank says, okay, the funds are there after they do the checking. It usually takes 3, 4, 5, 6 days.
I can't comment on what the intermediary process is, but that's the time frame that I'm referring to, yeah.
Another issue is being at a community college, being non-traditional students, there are a lot of students that are non-bankable. They have a hard time getting to go open account. So they have no other option but this because it's the only way that they can get their funds.
Can I also respond?
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Speaking as a student who just went through everything last year as a freshman, the process to which to get your account even set up to do direct deposit is one in which on the website and everything, there's no direct button. It takes you through a really confusing maze to even begin to set up the process for direct deposit, and you really have to go searching for that process if you're interested in it. It's never laid out for you at any point as kind of something that's like there even. It's not mentioned usually. So, yeah.
Tori, I would submit to you that the process of registering for classes is much more onerous than opening an account and registering for automatic deposit.
You know, I would like to agree with you, but having gone through it last year, it was a process that took me like an hour, which is surprising to hear for some. But the website is not one that's easily navigable for young students who are just now becoming on their own and learning everything.
Well, I'll take your word for it, but I bet there are some local bankers and some credit union people who would love to talk to you about their program. So
yeah, and I mean in terms of the higher one getting access to direct deposit, not in terms of my bank. My bank was nice about it. So.
Questions? Okay, thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Byer.
I'm curious. I'm under the impression that if you use a higher one ATM machine, that's I guess are available on campus, that there is no charge for that. There are a limited number of charges for months of free. Is that correct?
Yeah. Generally, the campuses that contract with Higher One will have built into the contract a number of ATMs on site. Mount Hood Community College, for example, had two. To my knowledge, Portland State University has three. I've only ever seen two of them. The difficulty is, at PSU in particular, it's almost always broken. And the agreements are, for instance, we can make withdrawals or take account actions without assessing fees, but we are still limited to a total of $500 a day in transactions, which means if your rent is over $500 a day and it's due on the 5th, you might be out of luck.
Okay. Thank you. Good luck in school. Eric.
Good afternoon, Senator Haas, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Knoop, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Knoll. I'm a student at PSU and serve as chair of the Oregon Student Association Board of Directors. The Oregon Student Association is a student-run, student-led nonprofit and advocacy organization founded in 1975 to protect and serve the collective interests of students in post-secondary education in Oregon. So this is an issue clearly right down our pipeline. I had the opportunity to testify twice as a student and as our board chair in the House Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency Committee on this bill, where a lot of concerns were brought up from members of the committee as well as the opposition, and we did address many of those concerns, if not all of them. And I'd like to reiterate some of those statements today in my testimony. I did provide written testimony for that committee, and it's available attached on OLIS as well. So if you're curious, you can reference that. I want to first address the nature of this bill. This bill is brought forward as an option to provide more transparency and more affordability to students. Higher One in 2012 made a gross total income of almost $200 million. Over $150 million of that was from fees assessed to student accounts. We were able to do this research and find these statistics because Higher One Incorporated is a publicly traded company, and we read through their end-of-year reports, and they listed their fees as 80 to 85% of their revenue. And so it's natural that a company like Higher One would be concerned about their ability to contract with institutions in the event that a 50-cent debit swipe fee would be prohibited. However, we've seen that there is no problem with the contracts at Southern Oregon University and Portland State University, and would question ultimately how much revenue that brings in for them, although it is quite a shock to students when they look at their bill and see there's a 50-cent debit swipe fee. doing the math really quickly, if you take a 50-cent debit swipe fee once per day, 7 days a week, recognizing that students make multiple transactions on a debit card per day, just take one fee per day for 7 days for 52 weeks, that's over $182, which is money that could have gone to gas, to books, to food, especially when we have a large percentage of our students on our campuses who are in need of emergency food resources. We've seen food pantries and food resources pop up on almost all community college and university campus because there are students.
Or for diapers for Mr. Gates' two-year-old.
Exactly, exactly. And this shows a necessity in students living on the edge as it is, and when students can't budget for that fee, it becomes very problematic. We're asking you today to prioritize the concerns of the students over the concerns of loss of profit of a company in Connecticut, in Oregon. When it comes down to it, this 50-cent fee, which is realistically probably the most contentious piece of this bill, should not be something that holds us back from passing House Bill 4102. Again, we've seen institutions be able to contract and write this out of their contract, and we're asking you not to stand alone as Oregon, but to stand ahead and be the first state to take this on and really pioneer the financial aid landscape for students as we continue to see challenges to this across the nation. I'll close by saying that students have provided very passionate testimony in both the House and the Senate and have addressed concerns related to all forms of the bill and providing a clear and concise fee schedule and providing direct deposit and paper check options and prohibiting debit swipe charges, prohibiting revenue sharing. Ultimately, we again are asking you to prioritize the needs of these students over the needs or concerns of institutions because we've seen that this hasn't been a problem. And we ask you all to move this to the floor and give Oregon the opportunity to be a leader in our nation. Thank you, and I'll take any questions if you have them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious. I've been told that PSU negotiated with HireOne to do away with the swipe fees,
mm-hmm.
But in doing that, the contract with HireOne cost them, I don't remember the number, but quite a bit of money that they had to pay Hire, and are charging that cost as part of their student fees across all students, those getting services through HireOne and those not. Is that accurate?
To my Chair House, Senator Beyer, to my knowledge, that is accurate. PSU has been contracted with HireOne since 2004, and when their contract renewed in 2009, they were able to write it out of the contract. It puts us in a situation as students in answering this exact question that we have to choose between the lesser of two evils. We're stuck in a situation where either the low-income students on financial aid in our campuses are charged these fees, or it's just assessed to our tuition because, unfortunately, there isn't enough funding for our institutions to operate at a low enough cost of tuition for students. This is an affordability issue and one that we are all collectively responsible for. At the end of the day, when we were quoted at Portland State from the director of our financial aid department, he quoted us at about $400,000 to $500,000 of what it would cost to go back to paper checks. To my knowledge, the service fee that was charged to Portland State after negotiating out the 50-cent debit swipe fee is nowhere close to that. And as students, ultimately, we would rather have that cost spread out amongst our entire body than targeting the neediest and lowest income students who actually need financial aid.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it is a bit of a dilemma. I mean, there is, I don't know what it is, but there is a real cost with covering these financial transactions, however you do it. I just know from experience with different governmental entities, it's sort of the rule of thumb is to cut a check for a government agency costs $25 to $30. So I can see why they might be wanting to do that. If that's a real cost, it's got to be borne by somebody in the system. And I guess from a student perspective, when I look at that, is you're either going to pay for that cost, if that's the way you do it, either directly by the user, or you're going to pay for it through higher tuition or higher student fees. It sounds like that's what Portland State grappled with, and they decided that they'd spread it over everybody.
Senator Cruz.
And Ms. Chair, I just wondered about some point in time, I mean, if we're targeting the third-party administration of this, then it becomes a cost to the school, and I'm wondering if we're going to be able to see some numbers as to how that would transition, because in some cases, having a third-party administrator is more efficient and cost-effective than adding to the bureaucracy of the institution to do that monitoring, and I think that's a real critical issue in this. So I'm getting some nods back there. We may hear something about that. Thank you.
Senator Robo. Oh,
actually, you basically made that comment. You said that when Portland State entered into the contract, the amount that kids were paying in fees was less than the amount that the overall contract was. Did I hear that correctly?
Chair Haas, Senator Roblin, that is correct. If institutions would charge a higher service fee than what it would cost to provide paper checks, it's my understanding that they would either go back to paper checks or find another provider. And to be clear, students are not asking to return to paper checks. We believe a debit card system is a great opportunity to receive financially much more efficiently. We see an example in Western Oregon University and the University of Oregon where the institution has a payroll department that actually directly deposits money from the institution to student bank accounts and offers students the opportunity to pick up cash, to pick up a paper check, or to have a paper check sent to them. And students have agreed with that and decided to do that at those institutions. We're not asking to go back to an archaic age of paper checks. We're just asking for fairness and transparency in the fees assessed to students.
Okay. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you for your time.
Well, let's hear from Higher One. George Arkelich, I don't know if you have others with you, but.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is George Arkelich, here on behalf of Higher One. Just for a little background, Higher One partners with colleges and universities to provide a broad array of payment, fund disbursement, and management tools to help them save money and enhance effectiveness while at the same time attempting to provide students with flexible and affordable transaction options to help them manage their finances. We're not a credit card company. We don't do mortgages. Other loans in that nature. Financial aid refund payments occur when a student has a residual financial aid money remaining after his or her tuition and fees have been paid, and students use this money for books, expenses, room, board, other living expenses that they may incur in terms of while pursuing a higher education. Prior to the introduction of electronic disbursement programs, the fund disbursement process the majority of higher education institutions used was paper-driven and took weeks and weeks for a student to receive their funds. The movement toward electronic disbursement of funds has grown dramatically in recent years. In 2008, the U.S. Department of Education actually changed the regulations to explicitly encourage electronic delivery and allow higher education institutions to establish policies for electronic delivery and sort of provided how these rules would work with third-party institutions. It's helped. This process, electronic disbursement, has helped hundreds of colleges and universities eliminate efficiencies and avoid millions of dollars in expenses. We've sort of taken on responsibility of just in terms of the process, when you have, you know, undeliverable checks that get bounced back, ACH fees, charges, you know, that universities typically did before. The other thing we do is we do a lot of Higher One prevents institutions from becoming victims of financial aid fraud. We audit student enrollments. We're able to sort of do detailed analysis through our software programs that basically is sort of in compliance with the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, and this has also saved institutions, millions of dollars. In Oregon alone, we've approximately helped do about 950,000 disbursements. So it's both a benefit for the institutions, but it's also, we think it's a valuable option for students. By leveraging technology, by moving money faster, HireOne is able to provide checking accounts at a significantly lower cost than traditional banks. We also provide alternatives for unbanked students who do not qualify for traditional bank accounts. You heard testimony before, you know, these were students who take paper checks and go to payday loan lenders, who often charge us, as we know, outrageous fees. You know, I wanted to highlight a few things in terms of transparency. A couple years ago, the Pew Charitable Trust did a study titled Checks Balances, Measuring Checking Account Safety and Transparency, and they looked at 36 of the nation's largest banks, and they looked at fee schedules and how clear that is. We basically worked with the United States Public Interest Research Group, USPIRG, as well as the Pew Charitable Trust to model our fee schedule after that. You know, I would Google, you know, HireOne fee schedule. I compare it to any other national bank as how clear it is. And even I was reading, you know, I hadn't read the New York Times study that or New York Times, you know, article, but just even highlighting, you know, some of the pieces that HireOne has already made considerable changes to ensure student accounts offerings are fair, fully transparent. You know, so I think in terms of transparency, we're doing what we can, and like I said, it's sort of modeling it after national studies. In terms of costs, again, that sort of seems to be one of the focal points. We think when you look at evaluating costs, costs should actually be looked at in the aggregate, not just simple fees. And again, you know, again, the Government Accountability Office study actually said that fees on college debit cards were not higher and in some cases were lower than basic student checking accounts. You know, on average, you know, students pay about $45 a year in terms of what their fees are. Again, there are lots of different ways they can use ATM charges. They can run their these cards as credit cards and not have to pay any fee. Like I said, there's a cost to everything. And right now we offer no monthly maintenance fees for students, no minimum deposit requirements, no minimum monthly balance requirements, no extended overdraft fees, kind of list that goes on and on, that some of these fees are what national banks charge. You know, the example has been, well, some people contracted around, I think Senator Beyer nailed it on the head. You know, what Portland State did was say, okay, every student at Portland State now charges or now pays a HireOne fee. And, you know, there was a lot of activity back in the days on Portland State's campus to get the administration to get away from those 50-cent deposit fees. And I can tell you right now, there's a lot of activity on that campus to say, oh, we didn't know we had to pay that fee, and now we're going to try to work with the administration so we don't have to pay that either. You know, it's a cost that has to come somewhere, and that's why we also understand that HireOne is not, you know, isn't for everybody. And when you get your financial aid, the thing that's always asked is, do you want a paper check, do you want to deposit it into your own banking account, or do you want to open up a HireOne account? And all those transactions are free of charge, and it's all U.S. Department of Education regulations. So from the day one, students have that option of transferring their money for free. HireOne shares the goals that students should be provided with access to low banking cost options that are transparent. We're working on doing that, easy to understand, and provide consumer protection. These are all central factors that universities and colleges consider in evaluating vendors, and we are proud to continue working with a large number of Oregon institutions. You know, I often get asked, you know, well, why doesn't all these institutions contract with credit unions? That's probably a question for the institutions, because I think we do offer a very good product that these vendors say, you know, we can work with. In terms of the revenue sharing piece, that's actually something we support. This was not a HireOne idea. This was actually a Portland State University attorney back in the days came up with a clever way of making the transition and being able to use some of those resources to help offset costs. Again, the GAO study, if you read, says that HireOne has been actively trying to get away from those revenue sharing agreements. I think there's less than 5%, you know, of all the institutions we contract with have revenue sharing, and I think the only two in Oregon are Portland State and Southern Oregon University, and we've sent notices to both those universities to say in our next contract negotiation we would prefer to stop revenue sharing, so we do agree with that. But, you know, for as much, you know, I think evil as we're portrayed, you know, the GAO study does say that there are a lot of positive things that these third-party institutions offer students in terms of speed with the money and accessibility. And so I would encourage, you know, moving forward, I'd love to, you know, to have a sort of a bigger conversation. I think one of the issues I keep hearing from students is the frustration of not knowing what they're paying, where they're paying it is. You know, should we be talking about, you know, when institutions enter into these contracts with third-party institutions that a student representative should be present so they know what's in it, what's not in it? I mean, we may find that given all the other options or where we put fees here or where we put them there, maybe that 50 cents debit fee is a better option. I don't know. But I think it's having that conversation with the students is where we should be headed. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. I'd like to put this in perspective. You talked about the evil that you portray, whether you think that's fair or unfair. Higher One was forced to pay $11 million back in restitution. Can you explain why that agreement was reached and what Higher One did wrong?
Chair Haas, I actually don't have a lot of the details of that settlement and the transaction. I know that it was settled without any admittance of violation of the law. They did basically, I think this has been sort of, you know, Higher One's been in existence since 2000. I think as we've gone through electronic disbursements and things are improving, I think it's been a matter of a sort of growing pains for everybody. And I think
growing pains.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some of this has been, you know, learning about the transactions. I mean, the fact that we can sit down and put a fee schedule together that everybody agrees makes sense. I mean, I think before that there was no model fee schedule, and so now we have it. Now we have been able to line up with what Pew recommends as best banking practices and good banking practices. I mean, that's a study that came out in the last few years, and I think, you know. If there has been, I mean, right now when you go to a Higher One's website and they have the fee schedule, you have to sit there and click through that you acknowledge all that stuff. Before, maybe they didn't have that. I don't know. And so now they
but
say.
But the word that Business Week used in their article was that you cheated students with extra fees. And that's Higher One will pay $11 million for restitution to students cheated by the extra fees. So that's where some of this comes from. And that is kind of the theater that we're writing legislation in to protect students who are already in debt. And I'm just asking you what assurance you have for students that won't continue or what assurance you could have for them, period.
Yeah, Chair Haas, I think, you know, again, you know, I can get you the details of that specific report. I think the assurances are, you know, sort of continuing to do what we're doing in terms of being more transparent, I think continuing to have open dialogue with students and the institutions. I think, you know, I've offered, you know, and Higher One has offered to come out and sit down, do advisory groups to see what we can do to make things better.
Isn't it correct, though, that you, the more fees that are generated, the greater the revenues for Higher One?
I mean, I think, yes, Chair Haas. I mean, more fee, I think that would be for any bank. I mean, nobody likes fees, and I think, you know, I have an Umpqua bank account, and I get an ATM charge when I go to a different account, and it's, I wish I didn't have to pay that, but it's a cost of having that bank account, cost of doing business, and it has to be paid somewhere.
You mentioned that you're trying to be transparent. Can you give us an example recently where you've changed policies on reporting or disclosure for students? Of the statement you made?
Well, Chair Haas, I think going back to the fee schedule, I think that is probably about as transparent as we can make it. This study was done. It looked at what is best banking practices, and they said, and we basically modeled everything in that study according on our website and tried to be as transparent, as clear as we could be. And when an independent study looked at that, we would be number two on the list of 36 banks in terms of best banking practices, and I'd be happy to show you that information.
Further questions? Senator Robler.
Yeah, so if I understand it right, and I think we talked earlier, if they use their debit card as a credit transaction, there's no fee. If they use it as a debit transaction, there's a 50-cent fee in some of the institutions. Others have been worked it out. Is that correct?
Yes. So, Senator Haas. Okay. Yeah, Senator Robler. Right now, actually, that's one of the things that we encouraged when we did the renegotiation with Portland State was Portland State also committed to doing a sign and swipe campaign so that they were posting around campus, like, don't use your debit card as a debit, use it as a credit card because there's zero fee. So essentially a student could have, you know, these transactions could take place throughout the day and they'd never have to pay a fee because they're always signing, you know, swipe and sign through the credit card option.
So, but my issue is, if you can encourage that, or if the pros can encourage it, then and you get nothing for doing it one way. You get 50 cents for doing it the other way. Why couldn't you do them both free? I mean, why have to encourage them to do one? Is it more expensive to do a debit transaction than it is to do a credit card transaction? From my experiences, it seems the other way around, but I could be wrong. So I guess I'm asking, is the debit transaction more expensive for the company than the credit?
Chair Haas, Senator Robin, yes, it is. And we actually pay an administrative sort of a FISERV company that does the debit transactions, and they take a portion of the 50-cent fee. We don't get it all. So when a student, you know, goes out and runs it 10 times or whatever, it's, you know, we're not getting all of that. We're being charged every time they run that fee. And I won't speak to the credit card, but as I think I had a conversation earlier, and maybe Senator Barr could elaborate to this, that there's no fee can be charged through a credit card swipe under new federal banking laws, but there is a fee when you use a debit card, and we do get paid for that.
So, hold on. So, eventually, the money from the credit institution comes to you that was left over after that. Is interest paid on that to the student, or do you use that money in order to make transactions that make money for the corporation as well?
Senator Haas, Senator Robin, I don't have a definite answer on that. I'd have to look that up.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, just occurred to me, because the difference between debit and credit is debit's an instant call and credit is not. Does that make a difference? I mean, you do a debit swipe and an instant call on the account, whereas credit card, it's an accumulated transaction. Is that correct?
Senator Haas.
I'm starting to get into banking questions.
I was gonna
Tim.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well,
yeah.
So I'm just wondering if you're doing something that's an instant call on an account rather than a, you know, because there's time sensitivity in that, whether that makes a difference in the financial aspect. It doesn't? Okay.
It's just that the federal government has said you can't do it on this one.
Yeah.
You can do it on the other. So they make a choice. Okay. So if the federal government decided to make a choice that you couldn't do that on debit cards, you wouldn't do it on debit cards. Okay.
What are the tips the financial protection, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau gives to students is that you choose an account before you arrive at school. It goes back to our previous conversation about having a local bank or credit union that has lower fees and you're all set up. But that, would it be correct to say that would work against you would not encourage that?
No, Senator Haas, I would support that. I mean, I think that's where the feds are, is to say up front, this is money that's being distributed to the students. Let's promote choice and opportunity.
If everybody did that, Hire One would have no profit model anymore.
I mean,
correct.
Senator Haas, I mean, I guess I'm confused. I mean, I think Hire One believes that their product is comparable, if not better, than some of the national banks. And so if we say you have a choice of where you want to go, you can have a paper check, you can have it put into your own bank, or you can go to Hire One. We have a 98% retention rate of our of students who choose to stay with Higher One. So I think there's a reason for that, and that is because people do, looking at the various fee schedules in ours, they choose to stay. And but that's, you know, I definitely support the opportunity up front in the beginning to say, you know, put your money where you want your money to go.
Other questions? Senator Robin.
Yeah, just for the record, you know, I heard some of the students say, and this isn't true necessarily, that it's difficult sometimes to have check cashing ability because they're not bankable. Most every institution has a associated credit union with it, and they encourage all their kids to get signed up. So I would just say that from a person, whether it's your local bank that you did in your local, I like community banks, or your other big bank, or your credit union, there are options, and I think most students should look into that. I just think it's important for them to have an idea. And if there's one with their institution, that's oftentimes very nice, too. So just encourage that kind of stuff. Have you ever tried the website that they talked about to actually transfer the money? I mean, I heard that it took an hour to get out of there through the website that you guys have to transfer money to their actual bank or credit union. Have you ever gone through the process to find out how difficult that is or whether it could be streamlined?
Chair Hass, Senator Roblin, I haven't. I have looked on their website, and I do, you know, it's pretty clear that they have their fee schedule, and a lot of the information is easy to find. But I don't have, you know, it's been a long time now since I've been a student, so I haven't had the PIN number and been able to, you got, you know, the secure account to walk through your options. Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for taking these questions. Appreciate it. John Wyckoff
said it was inappropriate.
Senator Hass, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Community College Association. And I just wanted to offer a little bit of perspective from the campuses on why we use third-party vendors in this case, and what we think actually are some of the very good elements of this legislation, but that would still need some adjustment, that we would hope would get some adjustment if it were to move forward. A little bit of background on why we do this. The disbursement of financial aid is something that's very labor intensive for a short amount of time every term. So over the course of you know, a 9-week term, you'll have about 3 to 4 weeks of very intense period of activity where you're dispersing financial aid, and then you have all these people that have nothing else to do for the rest of the term. And so what some colleges or universities would do is staff up with temps. Sometimes that works well. Sometimes it doesn't because it's fairly specialized work. And I know Portland State moved to this when I was, I think, still attending there. And part of the reason was because they were getting their financial aid out so late because they weren't able to do it, because it's a very difficult kind of workflow to manage. And it's important to keep in mind that, especially for the colleges, we've been making these decisions because when we've been looking at budgets that were cut 20% over the recession while our enrollment went up about 35%. So the colleges are really looking for ways to save as much money as possible doing things like this, so we can put our resources into things like advising for, you know, getting academic advisors and for the wraparound services that many of our students need. And so this has been one way to kind of alleviate some of that pressure for the colleges. And we really want to just make sure that we still have the option to enter into agreements like this. But we also want to make sure that our students have the best information possible. And that was why we made some of the recommendations for what should go into this and what ultimately ended up in the current version of the bill. But it is true that the GAO has made recommendations. There is a group at the federal level that through the Department of Education is making recommendations that includes the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, that includes the United States Student Association, includes Higher One, I think includes, you know, all of these folks. And what we would urge is that you make sure that there's some consistency between, if we're going to adopt new legislation in Oregon with regulations, that we remain consistent. And I'm not sure we have that yet with this legislation, but that we remain consistent with what they're they're doing at the federal level, because we're in complete agreement that what the GAO called for was making sure students get neutral information about what, the account that they're being offered, that they have access to an adequate number of ATMs, and that there is a level of public oversight, which we would say we have because our contracts go before locally elected boards and we have a public comment process when they adopt, when they go this route. We've had students involved, and when we've been picking contractors like Hire One. And so we just want to make sure that there isn't sort of an uncomfortable overlap between regulation at the state level and regulation at the federal level, which it seems is probably going to come. What would currently happen for a student when they, we have a couple of campuses that are doing this, Lane Community College, for example, if a student would receive something in the mail basically offering the Hire One account and telling them that they can take the Hire One account or use their local, or they use their own bank or credit union and have it transferred, or get a paper check. And if they go online and they choose whether to, when, if they choose the Hire One account, the fees are put, they are shown sort of the fee schedule. One of the things that we were kind of trying to get in the legislation was making sure that that's put clearly, but I think that might be something that requires a bit more work to make sure that it actually does what it's supposed to do. My understanding also from the bank, from Hire One, and from some of the folks in the banking industry is that the way we currently have it set up, it would require that from this time a student requests the funds, they could get, that they would have to, whether they request an alternative within 3 days, they would have to get get it deposited to their other account or a paper check, and that was actually our recommendation. However, one of the things that the banks had said and that they were hoping to change in the House but unfortunately didn't get made was a student could, just because of the way the bill is written, I think, request those funds before they've actually been put into anybody's account. You could make the request before Hire One's even received the funds, and so they wouldn't actually physically be able to do that in 3 days. So that would probably be something you'd want to look at modifying so that it's at least workable. And I think it's really important to remember that students have the option to use their own account or get a paper check, that nobody is forced into using these accounts. And we believe, you know, strongly that that looking at things like making sure the information about them is neutral are good steps to go, but that maybe this needs a little further work before we kind of move with what we have, with what you have in front of you. And the other thing I think to keep in mind, there have been a lot of numbers thrown around about the fee income that is generated from students, and that banks also get a lot of fee income. I think they're called interchange fees, and it's every time that a bank transfers fee between one bank. So when Hire One is listing their entire fee income, it's not all coming from students. It's also coming from these interchange fees, which are just fees that banks charge between banks when you use a credit transaction. And that was part of the conversation I think you were having before about it being more costly for, I think, the bank when you do a PIN transaction as opposed to the vendor if you go to the grocery store. I do it all the time because my credit union gives me points if I do a signed transaction instead of a PIN transaction, and so when I go to Fred Meyer's, I have to hit cancel, and then they say credit, and you hit credit, and you do it. I've not found anywhere where I can't do that. I can understand from students' perspective why they find that frustrating, that they should be have to. We don't have as much of an opinion on whether that's a good fee or not, so much as just want to make sure that the campuses still have the flexibility to use a service that has been effective for them and efficient in getting out these funds. And I think it's important to remember, I mean, especially in the context of what's been happening with our budgets, all we can do is shift the cost to students in a different way. It's not as though that by not assessing a fee or by Hire One not getting the fees in some other way, if that burden is then, if it's just put in an upfront fee to the campus, we could charge it in tuition, we could charge it in form of some other fee, but we don't have, you know, a big pot of money somewhere that if the campus's contract suddenly goes up, you know, $100,000 because of, you know, restrictions on contracting, I mean, students are going to pay that one way or the other, and the policy discussion I think for you all to have is it appropriate to do it one way or is it only appropriate to do it another way? But I want to be clear that, I mean, it's very difficult to do something like this the way that we're funded without shifting the cost to students. We don't have anywhere to shift the cost. And with that, I would close and take any questions.
Questions of the Community College Association. Okay. I appreciate your perspective. Thank you. Sammy Ally.
Good afternoon, Chair Hash, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sammy Alloy. I'm the Legislative and Policy Director for Oregon Working Families. I would echo a lot of the things that Representative Holvey and the students had to say about Higher One. And as someone who went to college later in life, I graduated when I was 30 and had already been participating in banking for my adult life, I would challenge any of you to make it through the website that Higher One gives you to choose your options and not become frustrated and irate. And so with that, as you know, the declining public funding for higher education is a serious concern, and campuses are looking to save money any way they can. Oregon spends $3 per inmate for every dollar on students, and the steady decrease in public funding has caused tuition to more than double, causing students to rely increasingly on debt to pay for college, with the average debt in Oregon now at $26,000. That's not news to anyone. And therefore, universities and colleges are outsourcing student services to save money. But you know, cutting support staff that are there to interface with students and help them succeed and create jobs in our local economy, I don't think that this is the best way. And financial institutions like Higher One are able to offer two contracts because they make 80% of their profits from passing fees on to students. But this is not just a, you know, I want to reframe the conversation about keeping the cost low for students to protect students that are going into debt, because I don't think it's just a question of how much students are going into debt, but rather how Oregon is using our public tax dollars that we invest in students to help them to succeed. Because Higher One's entire business model, as you heard from their representative, is based on administering these financial aid accounts to students. That means that every student that is using these accounts are a financial aid recipient, many of those Oregon Opportunity Grant recipients. That means that those students are often the neediest and the least prepared by their families to be successful in the financial sector. And when campuses are marketing these cards to students with their logo, and you get an envelope in the mail that says, "Don't toss this. It's the key to accessing your financial aid." Many students are not aware that they have the option not to use it. And I want to just talk about how I think that this conversation about couldn't students just opt out? Well, yes, they could. But I think that this is kind of a somewhat of a victim-blaming mentality, because many of the consumer protections that were passed after the mortgage crisis in 2008 do not apply to companies like Higher One, because they're not a bank, they're not a lender, they're not a credit card, they're a non-bank financial institution. And so they've been able to circumvent some of those regulations that passed as part of Dodd-Frank that we as a society have concluded are critical to allowing our economy to function. We can agree as a society that payday lenders are predatory and subpar mortgage lenders are predatory. And so when we know that Oregon is a cash-strapped state and we are making every dollar that we invest in our students in the Oregon Opportunity Grant count because we don't have a lot to go around, are we then allowing those dollars to flow straight out of state to a private for-profit corporation in Connecticut? And I would also add that we know, I don't have specific statistics, but we know that when we give dollars to lower income and middle income participants in our economy, that those dollars are more likely to be spent. Lower income people spend all their money in the economy. People in the financial sector, banking executives in Connecticut, aren't spending all their money. They're certainly not spending it in Oregon's economy, but they're not spending it at all. They're keeping it in long-term investments. students. So I would offer that there are a lot of alternatives that our institutions could look into with our local community banks and with participation from the state of Oregon to help our students succeed and to keep those dollars in our local economy, investing in jobs that will help contribute to the prosperity of our state and help us stay on track to meet our 40-40-20 goals. I'll take any questions.
Sure. Thank you for coming down, Kathy.
Thank you.
Aaron Knott.
I don't think Dodd-Frank was such a wonderful piece of legislation myself.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Department of Justice and the Attorney General here in support of House Bill 4102A. To explain why I'm here, first of all, you're receiving a letter from my boss, the Attorney General, in support of this bill, but we, much as legislators monitor national legislative trends, we do the same with what's creating national scale litigation. And so we've been tracking student debt issues and student finance issues pretty closely. And so part of why I wanted to come today was just to answer any questions you had about sort of that picture. I know a lot less about what's going on in Oregon than I do about what's been going on abroad, meaning other states. Looking sort of at the two aspects of this that we found the most interesting, before I go any further, actually, I should say we are not here to bash Higher One. Higher One is definitely, I think, something you can look to as a money saver in a time of very tight educational budgets. It can be an efficiency creator. It has definitely accelerated the speed with which students receive their financial aid. There are a lot of good arguments for that sort of a relationship. They do so flexibly via contract. They can treat different schools differently. These are all good things. But some of the sideboards that you see national litigation suggesting are important for you to consider as you look at this bill. First of all, the PIN or swipe fees. In some of the national litigation involving Higher One, you're seeing a lot of attention being paid to whether a fee structure is hitting different students differently. That was relevant with the discussion of Higher One with the FDIC. And part of the problem with PINs is, well, certainly they're hard to avoid. I think we've heard a lot of testimony about that. But I think the testimony you've heard from students also really drives home that this does not play out the same for one student as it does for another. If you're a commuting student, if you're a student that goes to a grocery store that doesn't have a swipe option, and we've heard of those, this is really tricky. There are students who are going to figure this out. They're going to figure always use a debit system. They're going to make that a priority. Maybe they're going to rely on paying cash, use Higher One ATMs, and be able, aware enough and able to work that into their schedule in such a way that they might not see any fees. Other students may, because they have to or because they don't know any better, get into the habit of, I go to the grocery store, I debit, grocery store debit, gas station debit, and the next thing you know, that student is looking at really a fairly hefty fee structure. I think it's always the case that any company that is being run intelligently is going to externalize their costs and migrate their cost out as much as they can. So I think it's absolutely logical to assume that if one fee is precluded, you may see an emergence of some other cost somewhere else. But what the litigation highlights is it's different when it hits different students differently than it is when it's sort of evenly spread. And although the PIN transactions are not the subject of that litigation, I think it does provide us with some lessons as to why it's important. Also, that it's important to remember that this is not any sort of, I mean, there are good efficiencies in making these contracts, but it's not a free market as far as these students are concerned. This is the provider, and it's often pitched as the provider, and that's something else in terms of the revenue sharing that nobody's really talking about, and I won't spend a whole lot of time on, but that also has been part of the discussion nationally. And we have seen situations where colleges and universities, they send out the Higher One materials, sort of this is how it works, this is how you sign up, this is why it's great, as part of their enrollment packages. And you can see a real conflation, I think, in the eyes of students between the university and Higher year one, that they're the same, that this is sort of your college debit card. It usually has the college logo on it. That can send a very strong impression that this is an official or mandatory or semi-mandatory financial method of accessing your financial aid. And when colleges have a financial stake in that, when they're actually getting a share of the revenue from that, it creates a real incentive. And Senator Roblin, I think you highlighted this accurately. They have a financial stake in making that card seem as inescapable and necessary as possible. So I think 4102A, and I'm sure the Attorney General's perspective here, is really being very specific and targeted about getting at some of the most serious aspects of what should otherwise, and I think often is, a very efficient and cost-saving, mutually beneficial relationship between Higher One and the colleges, which passes some of those savings on to the students. But it's all of this is done by contract. And that's, you see PIN fees some places, you don't see them other places. You see revenue sharing some places, you don't see them other places. And so even if Higher One steps forward, and they have been responsive to complaints, they are a market leader, but they are not a market monopolist. You cannot assume that contractual practice that is normal now will be normal in the future or will be normal across all companies. For those reasons, 4102 is a good idea going forward. I am open for any questions.
I just think there was a comment that came up earlier from the community colleges worried about the Fed bill changes that may be underway. If we get out in front of that, that there could be some conflict in the law, and that would seem to be a potential problem for you or our state. What's your comment on that, since you've been following these issues, I take it, nationally and in other states?
Chair Haas, that's a good question, but I would characterize the negotiations around federal legislation as highly preliminary. Representative Holvey, I think, made an accurate recitation of where the Department of Education is. I haven't seen specific enough federal legislation to know that we'd be responding, on that level of specificity to try to avoid a preemption, or even if the federal government will go in the direction of preemption. What I'm aware of now is we've concluded an FDIC investigation. The Consumer Finance Protection Bureau has an open analysis of not Higher One in particular, but contracting agreements, and there has been some discussion of class action litigation. What I have not heard is a concrete legislative proposal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rep. Johnson has joined us. Did you want to testify, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. For the record, Mark Johnson, House District 52. Just happened to be following along in the confines of my cozy office over on the fourth floor of the House building. And I actually am on the Consumer Affairs Committee, so I've had a chance to be a part of this discussion going forward. And I did not vote for the bill as it came out of committee, but I'm also someone who's around the education and the higher education world a fair amount as well. So I've had a chance to understand some of these issues. But my concern would be that what the Higher One and those people who do what they do. Do what they do because the colleges and the universities have elected to offload that service. There was a time when universities and colleges used to disseminate all those loans and so forth, but in the interest of trying to become more efficient, to put the resources where they need to be, which is i.e. and going to the students and so forth, to keep costs down and to put all the assets we possibly can at the students, they found another way to sub that out to somebody provide that service. So that's what the Higher Ones of the world do. But I think it's important to recognize that these are not to try to draw a parallel between them and a mortgage company or a bank is not accurate. You've got a different demographic you're working with, and not to be critical, but some students are not necessarily the highest credit worthy folks around. So sometimes the fees are going to necessarily be a bit higher just because of the demographics of who you're working with. They may not have credit at all, but they're able to have this extended to them and so forth. So it's not an apples to apples comparison, is what I guess I would say. But I think, too, we heard during the committee, and I know it's been brought out today, that the federal issue, the feds are looking at this topic as well. I would be reticent about Oregon getting too far out in front of our skis on something like that, imposing something that then the feds would come back with something that might be a different regulation as well. So my point would be I don't know that you can have it both ways. I mean, everybody wants to have the cheapest, most effective, easily accessible credit and access to something that's as convenient as possible. but it doesn't come without a cost. And if the cost is shifted from, if the cost to hire one or whoever's providing that service go up, the costs to the institution who's contracting for their services will go up, and I believe the cost to the students will be going up as well. And there's only one place that that can come from, and that's in either fewer services, fewer academic offerings, or higher tuition. So that would be my concern about this bill going forward, Mr. Chair. And maybe it's a time to see how this goes during the interim, maybe come back and take another look at it in 15, monitor what happens at the federal level in the meantime, and then we'll know whether there is a concerted, serious effort to try to address this and have a level playing field across the country. So with that, I'll conclude and let you guys get on with your business.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Johnson? All right.
Thank you
for your comments, sir. Okay, that concludes everyone who was invited or who signed up to testify on this legislation. I think what this bill to me is a terrible symptom of a terrible problem we have in this country, and it's a mountain of debt, $1 trillion high, owed by students. And I have absolutely no sympathy for companies that in some cases, as has been documented in the past, gouge students on these fees. With this bill, if we were to move forward, some of the issues are technical, as was raised by the community colleges, and we would need some more time to fix those. This bill is not shipshape. This is a short session. We would need a couple of amendments and maybe some refinements. More significantly, though, there are some actions moving forward in the federal government at the Department of Education as a result of this GAO report that I would like to see start to gel before we did anything in Oregon. So for that reason, I would stand down on this bill for today. If the situation hasn't improved by the end of this year, I will sponsor the bill in the 2015 session that protects students from unreasonable fees on their borrowing. Comments from the committee?
Yeah.
Senator Cruz?
Mr. Chair, I would agree with you. This is once again another example of a real issue that needs to be dealt with due to the contracted length of this short session. We really don't have the time to fully flesh out. I mean, you know, the House did what they did, you know. This is the first time this committee's seen this bill, and I think there are issues here that need to be addressed. I agree with you that we don't let this die, that we put some time into it during the interim and bring it back in 15 if need be. I would agree with that.
Senator Wilburn.
I'm okay with that. I hope that the different universities and different institutions have heard today clearly that there are different ways to enter into contracts. And we've heard from the group itself that this cost sharing is not something they kind of agreed with the stuff that was done here. So if we can get out of some of that, if people show, if as they do their contracts, if they start showing some understanding of some of these issues so that we don't see some of these conflicts that I think are inherent in some of it, and we get some other ideas about how they could do the cost. Portland State has found one way to do that and sharing that cost across the board. I would like to give them an opportunity to figure that kind of stuff out, and maybe best practices amongst the institutions would be helpful. But I agree with you. If they don't, we need to come back with something.
Right, and it's worth noting, I think, that now we have university boards where universities individually can work on this without this state solution. Representative Beyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
I'm in agreement that there's an issue here that needs to be taken care of. I don't think we have the time to deal with it right now. If we were going to do something, the one point that the Attorney General brought up, the cost-sharing idea, I don't know how prevalent that is, but I think that absolutely from public policy should be eliminated. So we take the incentive away from that. I'm a little surprised and a little annoyed that the colleges haven't done a better job of helping their students understand the process. And I have to say that, you know, I've only heard the testimony. I haven't gone on, and I don't even know if I could go on to the higher one side and see how that works there. But it strikes me that a website could be created that more clearly laid the choices out and the cost to do that. Having said that, there are real costs that we're talking about here. And as the community colleges said, those costs have to be borne by somebody. I mean, you just can't do away with the cost. And the question is, what's the best way to deal with that? Do we socialize them, or do we put those on some of the people? And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding of the fees that go along with debit cards and credit cards. Congress changed that a couple of years ago, had a significant impact on lending institutions and the way they deal with that. But there are costs that are embedded in those, and usually they're borne by the merchant, but it also, that's partially how you subsidize the cost of this financial services, those fees that are charged. So this one needs a little more looking into.
Mr. Chair, just to point on what Senator Byer just said, the costs that are borne by the merchant end up being part of the cost of doing business, and so the consumer pays it one way or another. So it's just a matter of...
It's another way of socializing.
All right. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4102. Gentlemen, we do have a hearing on Thursday on this issue of hours in school and days in school, and it's significant in that it was this agreement to have an informational hearing in lieu of legislation, and so it's somewhat of a thorny issue, so we'll need to look at that. So thanks for your hard work in this deadline time, and we'll see each other on Thursday. We are adjourned.
So Thursday is just a public hearing.